Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Paul Auster, whose latest novel is Man in the Dark. Recent novels include Travels in the Scriptorium, Oracle Night, Brooklyn Follies. A couple of years ago, a film, The Inner Life of Martin Frost. Paul Auster, in reading three consecutive books of yours, you kind of get similarities and differences. One thing I noticed, which is actually not about Man in the Dark, Oracle Night involves a character named John Trouse who writes a short story that is thrown away and lost on the subway. That short story somehow reappears as a story the character is reading and travels in the scriptorium.
That's a very astute remark. I'm glad you saw it. Travels in the Scriptorium is a book in which many of the characters from my previous novels resurface. So Trouse is one of them by means of the story, but we have numerous characters. Anna Bloom from In the Country of Last Things, Marco Fogg is mentioned, Daniel Quinn from City of Glass. So they come back, and they're haunting the mind of Mr. Blank, the befuddled, aging prisoner in this strange room where he's been locked up.
What were you doing?
I think I was doing, in that book, several things at once. I wanted to talk about old age and memory loss. Mr. Blank's predicament is, I would say, similar to that of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of old people who are somewhat demented, living in homes, institutions of one sort or another, and they really don't know where they are. So he's afflicted with this. He's undergoing what they call the treatment. It's quite mysterious. Also, it's a book about inventing characters, imaginary characters, and what happens to them after you finish writing a book. They continue to exist. And the irony being that the creations of a writer outlive the writer himself.
As you're talking, I hear echoes of your new book, Man in the Dark.
Well, I think of it as a diptych, these two. I mean, both of them have old protagonists. I think Mr. Blank is older than August Brill in Man in the Dark. Both books take place in a room. Travels in the Scriptorium takes place during the course of one day. Man in the Dark, during the course of one night. So there are parallels, and yet the books are very different in aspiration, in tone, nearly everything. But somehow mirror works.
The other mirror is the story within the story, which is pretty clear. And in an interview you gave in the New York Post in August, you were talking about the dystopian element in both books, stories within stories, and we'll get into that entire story within a story thing in a little bit. But those stories, the one that Blank is reading and travels in the scriptorium, and the one that August Brill is imagining in his bed in Man in the Dark, take place in these alternate worlds where there's revolution or something going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty clear they're not the same alternate world, for sure. You said the idea of the second American Civil War that happens in Man in the Dark came about because of what happened in 2000 and how you feel as if we're living in an alternate reality. And I have been living the past 8 years with exactly that thought.
Oh, interesting. Well, I think we're not alone either. The 2000 election was one of the most scandalous moments in American history, it seems to me. Al Gore was elected president, and through legal and political maneuvering, the Republicans stole it from him. When that happened, I thought the entire country would be up in arms. It wasn't. Americans just kind of rolled over and let it happen. I was amazed at how little protest there was. But I have been raging myself ever since about this, as things have gone from bad to worse over these years. The thought that this shouldn't have been our reality becomes more and more pressing. I mean, reality is Al Gore is finishing his second term. There's no war in Iraq. 9/11 might not even have happened on his watch. So I think this story that Brill invents for himself comes out of these frustrations on my part about what we've been living through under Bush.
There's also the idea of the story within the story and the relationship of all of them, which is that the character of Brick that he's imagining is given the task of killing the author.
Yes, and it's something that Brill comes to during the course of telling himself the story. In the beginning, he says, I wasn't thinking of it in those terms. But the deeper I got into the story, the more necessary it seemed to push it in that direction. And for me, that story is a reflection of Brill's state of mind. I mean, he's a man suffering from many sorrows and many problems. His wife has died recently. His daughter, his grown-up daughter, is divorced and living alone in Vermont in the country. She's a teacher. And his granddaughter, 23-year-old Katya, who's also living in the house with them now, has dropped out of school because her boyfriend has been murdered in Iraq. It's a house of grieving souls, really. And I think the darkness of Brill's story is a reflection of his state of mind.
August Brill himself has characteristics that apply to Paul Auster. They apply to the main characters of both Brooklyn Follies and Oracle Knight. And it appears also the character in The Inner Life of Martin Frost, your movie. The idea of writers imagining stories and the stories themselves is a recurring theme, particularly in these works.
Yes, I agree with you. This is not the only kind of book I've written over the years, as you know, but these particular works, but I would say, yeah, especially Oracle Knight. I'm looking at the books on the desk here. Oracle Knight, Travels in the Scriptorium, and Man in the Dark do share that kind of structure, which is, what do you want to call it? Russian dolls, Chinese
yeah.
box, or sometimes I like to think of it as collage, in which you have several elements in a work with spaces between them. And I think a certain energy is created in those spaces, which somehow makes each element a little more interesting than it would be if it were just standing on its own.
They reflect back on each other.
Yes, yes.
In Oracle Knight and in Man in the Dark, you seem to be going on two parallel tracks, and then at a certain point, because Oracle Knight involves the story of a guy who chooses to disappear, and in this one it's just the story of this character Brick wandering this alternate universe, at a certain point about, I don't know, maybe halfway through Oracle Knight and two-thirds of the way through Man in the Dark, our hero just ends the story.
Yes, you're right. You're right. Well, again, in both cases, the story is a reflection of the inner turmoils of the person who's inventing the story. In Oracle Knight, Sidney Orr is a young man. He's in his 30s, but he's been ill, and he's hasn't written in a long time. He nearly died, and he's recovering. And he comes up with an idea for a story, and he's roughing it out. He works himself into a corner, and he doesn't know how to go on with the story, so he abandons it. Same thing with Brill. Well, he comes to the end of his story, actually.
Well, he ends it prematurely, though.
Prematurely because he's checkmated himself.
So it's the same thing. He's gotten himself into a corner.
Yeah, yeah. And yet, somehow, you know, it makes it sound as if it's almost the same book, and yet the books are completely different in tone and subject matter.
When you're writing it, do you know where they're going, or do you find yourself in that box? I mean, is it a box for you or just for the fictional authors in the book?
No, it's not a box for me. I intentionally ended the stories the way I did for very specific reasons. I mean, in the case of Oracle Knight, Orr's story about Nick Bowen, I could have found any number of solutions to get Bowen out of the room he's stuck in, but I didn't want to. I thought it's much better to leave him down there and
starving to death.
Yes, yes. Bowen's gonna. But he's just a figment. He's not real. He's somebody that Sidney is contemplating writing about. And really, what we have are a series of notes about how to write this story. Well, he runs into a brick wall and can't go any further.
And in the case of Brill, where do you go from there unless you break the wall between fantasy and reality and have Brick show up at August Brill's door?
That's right. And Brill is not going to do that.
And Paul Auster can't do it without turning the book into a fantasy.
That's right. That's right. Man in the Dark continues, obviously. There are a number of other stories he's thinking about. He's just trying to make up stories to pass through this difficult night of insomnia. Other notions come to him. He thinks of some other things. And then Katya comes downstairs. A large part of the rest of the book is a long conversation between the two of them.
What was the germ of the idea? I mean, we have the germ of the idea of the story within the story, but the germ of the idea of a man sitting there with insomnia thinking up stories.
I don't know. It popped into my head one day, and I thought, well, I think this is what I want to do. Ideas for me come out of the unconscious. I never sit down and say, I want to write a book about something. I want a book to have this form. It's always the so-called content that bubbles up from somewhere and then seems to grab me in some way. And then it's the content that dictates the form, always, always. I'm not writing sonnets. It's not as if I have a prefabricated notion of 14 lines and I'm going to get everything I can into this form. No, it's the other way around.
Well, when you're writing them, do you begin to see, like, I'm finding these connections here between these books because I read them all in a row. But do you see those connections when you're writing them? Do you try to just, like, put up a wall between the connections?
No, I see them and I feel them and I'm aware of them. And as you said at the beginning, I mean, Trouser's story resurfaces in another novel. So I was aware of what I was doing.
So all of this is absolutely conscious manipulation on your part? Or, I mean, if it bubbles from the unconscious, you're sitting there writing, right?
Yeah. I mean, to say the stories seem to make themselves up. I'm not forcing anything. It's hard to describe. I've never been able to witness the birth of an idea. One minute I'm walking along and I don't have any particular idea about a book or a story in my head. And then an instant later, something is there that wasn't there before. And I've never seen the synapse. I've never seen the connection. I've never witnessed it. So it's all very mysterious.
Paul Auster, The Inner Life of Martin Frost, which was the second movie you directed, where does that fit in? I mean, obviously you're working on a certain track here. Not only where does it fit in, but what dictated the form of a film rather than a book?
Well, not long after I made Lulu on the Bridge, which came out in 1998, so early 99, I was contacted by a German production company, and they were planning to make a series of 12 short films, 30-minute films, on the subject of men and women. And they asked me to write and direct one. And I thought this would be an interesting challenge. Make a film for two people only, with a very limited budget, one location. I wrote the text, and they liked it very much, and we started preparing to produce the film. But then it turned out that the contract that they were proposing stipulated that one-third of the budget would be given on signing the contract, the next third when we started filming, and the final third when the film was finished and they approved it. And I thought, wait a second, what if they don't like it? Then my poor producer is going to be stuck with one-third of the budget. A friend of mine, Hal Hartley, American filmmaker, was doing another one of the films in that series, and he'd run into tremendous trouble with them, and they had made him reshoot things. He was actually out of pocket quite seriously to finish his film. And he said to me, Paul, don't sign. Don't work with them. It's a bad idea. So I withdrew. At that moment, I said to myself, well, good, because this short film I actually would like to make into a feature film. I think there's more to be told here. I made a lot of notes about how to continue the screenplay and then put it all aside and started working on The Book of Illusions. This is a novel that I wrote between 99 and 2001, a book in which one of the central characters is a long-missing silent screen comedian. During the course of the book, whose name is Hector Mann, my protagonist, Zimmer, goes to see Hector, who's indeed alive, somewhere out in New Mexico, and has been secretly making films for the last years. One of those films turns out to be The Inner Life of Martin Frost. You see, I had that screenplay sitting on my desk. And when I came to a moment when I wanted to show one of Hector's later films, I realized that this was a perfect match. I wanted to do the long version, but I realized I couldn't because it would have thrown the novel out of whack. It would have been too long. That little film would have taken up too much space. So reluctantly, I stuck to the short version, the original version of the screenplay, transformed it to fit the circumstances, and rewrote it as a piece of prose. I finished the novel, and I thought, well, Martin Frost is finished. I'm not going to ever go back. And too bad, because I always wanted to see what it would look like on screen, but I've done it. Well, a few more years went by, and I kept thinking about the story. I think it was after I finished The Brooklyn Follies in around 2004. And I said to myself, well, let me see. I'm going to write it, see what happens. So I wrote the screenplay. Based on the earlier notes. And then luckily was able to make the film. It was a very small production. It was under $1 million. We filmed it in Portugal. I had just 4 actors, 3 locations, and that was it. Wonderful actors, by the way. David Thewlis, the British actor. Johan Jacob, French actress. Michael Imperioli, American. And my daughter, Sophie Auster, who's a very talented young singer and actress. They were wonderful, and it was great to do it, and I'm happy with the results. And it's one of the oddest little films you'll ever see.
What kind of release did it get?
Very tiny. It was distributed by New Yorker Films, which is a wonderful company with a distinguished list over the years. But they have no money. I mean, they're broke. And so it was released in New York City at the IFC Theater, and that was it. And then DVD.
How did the DVD work? Did you have anything to do with that?
Well, yeah. I worked very hard on all the color timing. I have to say it took me months to transfer the film, because we shot on 35mm film, to a high-level video. On the DVD, too, there's a documentary that someone made about the making of the film, which is quite interesting, I think, well done. And that's it. No commentary.
Well,
no.
Could you ever see yourself doing a commentary for one of these films?
Well, I did do commentary for Lulu on the Bridge DVD and also Smoke and Blue in the Face, but I didn't want to do it for this one.
And what's the story of In the Country of Last Things, which is an Argentinian film?
No, it's not going to happen. There was a young filmmaker with the wonderful name of Alejandro Chomsky. He wanted to make the film in Argentina. It was the moment when Argentina collapsed, and the book spoke very directly to him about many things. And I liked Alejandro and gave him my permission reluctantly. I mean, because I generally don't want my books turned into films, and I say no to everybody. But there was something so persuasive about him, and I said, go ahead. I even helped him with the script, and it seemed as if he had the money for a while, but it all collapsed. And now that this thing has dragged on for 5 or 6 years, I just don't see that this film is going to get made.
You're listening to an interview with Paul Auster, whose latest novel is Man in the Dark. The entire history of alternate universe tales goes back in the world of science fiction. I remember when I was a teenager or maybe younger reading a book by McKinley Cantor called If the South Had Won the Civil War. Uh-huh. And at the same time, there was another one, I can't remember the name of it right now, which might have won a Hugo for The South Winning the Civil War. Did you read a lot of science fiction, alternate history?
No, I was never interested in science fiction. It's interesting. I know a lot of boys are, adolescent boys, but I never cared for it. And I don't look upon any of these stories that I've written as science fiction at all. It's just ruminations is what I would call them, more than science fiction.
The idea of the alternate history, though, is really interesting. Do you feel like we're moving into another bifurcation now?
Right now, we're poised on the precipice, as people like to say. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen to us. It seems as if we're in a very dire situation as a country right now. The day we're speaking, the headlines are, you know, the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the panic on Wall Street. So one has this feeling that American capitalism is crumbling. The prospect of the Republicans remaining in control, especially someone as unstable as John McCain, who's a real hothead, I think, and would be a terrible, terrible president, is so frightening to me that I'm trembling in my boots.
Is there anything a writer can really do?
No, of course not. I tend not to write so-called political novels, but I think the force of these years has allowed political material to start creeping into the things that I've been doing because I feel so submerged in it, and it's hard to stop thinking about it. I mean, in some sense, every novel is political, and in some sense, not at all. But the imaginary and the real intersect all the time, because after all, the things we're imagining are based on realities, even the realities of unreal things.
When I was looking you up in Wikipedia, and this talked about the theories of Jacques Lacan. Now, who was Jacques Lacan, or is he, and what relationship do those theories have with your work, if any?
Jacques Lacan is a real person. He's dead now. He was a very, very well-known French psychoanalyst who took Freud's theories about the unconscious and went in another direction. It's quite interesting. And what Lacan is most famous for, and I think I probably was mentioned because in an interview I gave many years ago, I talked about Lacan's theory of the mirror stage, which is actually quite incredibly interesting. It's about the birth of the self and how we become human. And according to Lacan, it's the interaction between mother and infant. The baby looks up at his mother, and he sees the mother looking at him or her. And in that gaze, which is the mirror, he understands that he's a separate self, and therefore can look back at her, and she's not him, and he's not her. They're two different beings. It emphasizes, I think, the fact that we create one another. We're not autonomous beings. Human life comes out of other human beings, and that's how we learn language, because there are other people to teach it to us. You take it farther, you see, and then you're in political territory very quickly. Republicans, Democrats. Republicans think that we are autonomous beings, that we are not responsible for one another, that we don't live in a society, that humanity is not a matter of the collective trying to pull together, but just every man for himself. But I think psychologically, spiritually, morally, it's simply not true. And so I think the work that psychiatrists, psychoanalysts, neurologists have been doing continue to confirm this fact that we belong to one another and we make one another.
And how do you think this applies to your own work?
My work is very much, and since the very beginning, when I was just writing poems as a young man, a search for the other. I think that's what the core of the things I'm trying to do is reaching out to somebody else.
Back in grad school, I learned all about the nature of solipsism and how, on some level, you know, we can't escape ourselves. I mean, that's where solipsism and, I guess, phenomenology both begin.
Yeah, sure. We're locked in our heads. I mean, we live alone in some way. We really do. But then, in very important ways, not. When I was 20 years old, I wrote something which I rediscovered years later, which seems to me to sum up everything I've done and tried to do since. And it's two sentences. And this is my worldview then. And it went like this. The world is in my head, period. My body is in the world, period.
It's almost like a summation of the ending of Man in the Dark, in which Brill is pulled out of his head into the world of his body when Katya shows up at
that's
the end
right.
of the book.
That's right. And the connections they feel are very deep. He really, truly cares about this young woman, his granddaughter. These love relations, these connections are what is keeping him alive, really.
And in a way, you know, looking at something like Travels in the Scriptorium, we see the same effect when the characters actually come into the room where Blank is.
Exactly. And his tremendous affection for Anna, It's just something that runs through the entire book. Without attachments, we're nobody.
Oracle Knight trying to find that connection with his wife.
Yes.
It's the same thing.
Yes, yeah. I mean, Oracle Knight finally is a complex love story and about how a marriage which is in some kind of danger repairs itself.
Paul Auster, when you were talking a moment ago about Lacan and the mirror, I kept thinking, and about the difference between Republicans and Democrats, it occurred to me that Republicans, when they look at Democrats, they see Democrats doing the same things they do, but Democrats don't do that. They assume that the lying and the cheating is going on the other side.
Oh, yes, yes, of course, yes, yes, yes. Well, it's interesting. I flew out here yesterday from New York, and on the plane they were showing a film, which I had seen on television, Recount, the HBO film about the 2000 election.
Right.
And there's one character played by Bob Balaban, who's on the Republican side, and he says, I can't believe they're such cheaters. He's talking about the Democrats, that they're going to lie and cheat to win this election. And the very fact that the Democrats didn't cheat resulted in the loss of the election, and it was the Republicans who cheated. I think America from the very beginning has been split between people who believe in every man for himself and people who believe we have responsibility toward one another and we live in a society. And this has been the great debate from the beginning. And we go back and forth in different moments in our history. One of these tendencies seems to predominate over the other. But I would think that after 40 years of this conservative ascendancy, beginning with Goldwater and coming to a rather dismal end with George W. Bush, maybe the cycle's over. Maybe we're ready for something else. I hope.
In examining Man in the Dark and looking at it, you're dealing with all of these multiple stories, this collage effect. When you've got the final work, when you've written it, assuming that you're letting your unconscious come through, on the rework, what goes on in your mind as you read it? Do you see surprises in the rewrite?
Yeah, absolutely. I have a sense, every time I start a book, of what I think I want it to be. A sense of the shape, the beginning, middle, and end, the trajectory, as people call it, the arc. But then I sit down, I start to write, and everything changes all the time. And every day, I'm discarding ideas that I thought were good, and finding new ideas. And it really is an adventure, writing a novel. It's not mathematics. There's no one way to do it. So I'm surprised. I'm always, in the rewriting, just trying to make the prose as tight and beautiful and effective as I can make it. And then cutting. I cut. I want to trim things down to the bone just about.
Do you take out actual stories within the story?
Sometimes, too? Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
There's a couple of brief stories toward the end about World War II. They could all be expanded.
Yes. Those are all true stories, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. And they're really quite remarkable, it seems to me. The story about the school teacher in Belgium who was put in a concentration camp. I don't even want to talk about it. It's so grim, this story. But that's a true story, and all of them. And even in the novel, as you remember, there's a moment when Brill is remembering going into Newark, New Jersey in 1967 and witnessing the riots. Well, I was there. I saw it. And that man who, Gil, his brother-in-law, was a stand-in for my stepfather. And I really did walk in to City Hall the night of the riots and see the mayor of Newark, Hugh Adonisio, crying at his desk in total despair about what to do. And I really did see the colonel from the state troopers walk in and say something like, we're going to kill every black bastard in this city. Frightening day, times.
What prompted you to wait till now to put it in a novel?
This was the moment. This is the book about war. I have many stories that I haven't used yet.
A lot of people put a lot of their own personal lives and histories in their novels to make them almost memoirs. What do you think of that idea?
It's fine. I mean, the great example would be Marcel Proust, who wrote one of the finest novels ever written, and it comes directly out of his own life. whatever works. It doesn't. There are no rules about these things. I myself tend not to write autobiographical novels because I've written autobiographical books, and you know, The Invention of Solitude and Hand to Mouth, The Red Notebook. But still, every once in a while, I'll use something from my own life, transform it, and put it in a novel when it's appropriate. Sometimes very small things.
Do you ever think about writing a memoir?
No, I don't really want to do that. It's crossed my mind once or twice, and each time I've held that idea up in the light for a moment, I turn away in disgust. Some writers have written fantastically interesting memoirs. It's just not something I want to do.
Well, Paul Auster, what about the screenplay world and the directing world? You said before we went on the air that you don't think you ever want to direct again.
Well, I would love to direct again. It's just that the movie business has changed so much since I got into it in the first place with Wayne Wang and with Smoke and Blue in the Face. This is back in the early 90s, and we worked on those films for a while before we shot them, and they both came out in 95, so we filmed them in 94. It seemed as if the world of independent films was thriving then. Smoke played at the Angelica Theater in New York for 8 months back then in 95. This would be unthinkable today. All I see are filmmakers struggling to get financing, and if and when they do, struggling to get distribution. Curiously enough, last year, exactly a year ago, I was president of the jury at the San Sebastian Film Festival in Spain, and two Americans won awards. One of them, my old friend Wayne Wang, who made a beautiful film, which is just about to come out now, A Thousand Years of Good Prayers, and John Sayles. Now, these are two of the sort of the veterans of the independent film movement in the United States. So it was the night of the ceremonies. We were standing backstage, and I asked him, so who's distributing your films? Wayne said, I don't have a distributor. And Sayles said, I don't have a distributor either. I'm going to distribute it myself. And this is commonplace now in the world of films. And it's so hard to make a film. It takes so much out of you. There's such pleasure, too, I must add. Great, great pleasure. But the idea of making a film that no one's ever going to see is rather depressing.
Well, how do you feel then about something like Martin Frost, which never really gets released and then disappears into the... I mean, it's available.
It's available on DVD.
But people don't know about it.
No, I know. Well, it's rather sad, and I'm glad I made the film. But it has only the possibility of a very marginal future. It's a film that some people will see, and most people will not.
Which is sort of what happened with Lulu on the Bridge, too.
Yeah.
Not that you're ever going to go in this direction, but it seems that the most creative outlet now in the media is the cable television series, the limited series there, and that's it.
I know. There are some good things that have been done on TV in recent years. I think that film festivals are a place now where people get to see films that aren't going to be distributed. And there are more and more film festivals around the world, around the country, in the United States. But that's one time only. You get to see it, and then it's gone.
So the world that you knew as recently as a decade ago is gone.
It is. It is gone. And it's rather amazing to see what has happened. But the pressures of the business in Hollywood are so enormous, and people are so cautious. Nobody wants to lose his job. So they keep backing rather mediocre things, and that movies I don't even want to see.
Do you have any screenplays sitting around waiting then?
No, no. Uh-huh. But I should say, if I ever do get an idea for another film, I'll probably try to do it.
And does that keep you from writing novels then? I mean, can you work while you're doing that?
No. Making a film is very time-consuming. You're working 18 hours a day.
How long did it take from when you had to put your writing aside to when you were able to pick up the pen, in quotes, during the making of Martin Frost?
Oh, well, that had a kind of fitful career. I wrote the screenplay, and then found a producer, but we just couldn't raise the money. And so everything went on hold for about 8 months, and that's when I wrote Travels in the Scriptorium. And then my producer, Paulo Branco, is a Portuguese independent producer. He's made over 250 movies, Paulo. He's the last bastion of small film. When we decided to make it in Portugal, then it became possible because we couldn't get the money in the United States to do it. So I recreated Northern California and Portugal.
Well, when you're going to actors, I assume you're doing minimum.
Oh, yeah.
That's and people why, like Thulis are perfectly willing
that's
to
That's why
it.
I can't go through agents. I have to call the actors directly. But I knew David, and I knew Ian, and I knew Michael Imperioli, and I love them as actors, all three. I called them and said, look, here's the project. There's no money, very little money. And if you go through an agent and you say, no money, they take the script and throw it in the garbage. So, because they want their clients to make money so they can make money.
Had Imperioli finished his work on The Sopranos by that point?
Yeah, he had just finished. It was done. Michael and I go back. He auditioned for Smoke back in 1994. I remember Wayne and I thought he was great, but he was too young for the part. And then I hired him for Lulu on the Bridge, a small part, and he got something better, a bigger part. And the deal is with a small part, you let the actor go. But I always wanted to work with Michael. And when I wrote this part of Fortunato, the crazy plumber writer in Martin Frost, Michael seemed ideal for it. And he read it, and the next day he said, I'm in. We had a great time.
Paul Auster, now that you've you're on your tour for a book that you actually finished several months ago, have you begun?
Over a year ago. Yeah.
Have you been working? Have you finished something else?
I'm just coming to the end of something else, another novel. Different from the ones we've been talking about, longer also. I'm still trying to figure out what I've done.
Well, when you say that, what do you mean?
I don't know. It's still settling in my mind. Every time you write something, you've jumped off the edge of a cliff, and I haven't landed yet. And it might be done. I think the book is done. I think so.
What's the name of it?
Invisible.
You've been listening to an interview with Paul Auster, whose latest novel is Man in the Dark, and The Inner Life of Martin Frost is available on DVD. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.